All right, that's it, everyone. Let's get to work. Beep, beep.
Beep, beep.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 256 for the week of June 17th, 2019. I am Pink Embassy David T. Cole, and I'm here with Parking Prodigy Sarah D. Bunting.
Got it in one.
Bad Budgeter Tara Ariano.
I ran out of minutes.
And Glossy Lip Guapo Priest Omar Gallega.
Do you like my glossy lips? They're so glossy.
Oh, Padre Antonio, why are your lips so glossy? Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. We welcome our guest, Omar Gallega. Hello, Omar.
Hi, Omar.
Yay! Hola.
We are here to talk about Los Espookies, the new comedy show on HBO Friday nights. And why don't we start with Omar, since you went to the screening at the recent much-plugged ATX TV Festival here in Austin. How was the panel and what did you learn before we talk about the actual show?
The panel was really pretty delightful. It was Fred Armisen and some of the show's creators who I was not as familiar with. I actually was not super familiar with Julio Torres. I'm learning a lot about him now. I'm like, oh yeah, he wrote all those sketches that I loved on SNL, Wells for Boys. I had no idea that was him. The panel was really about kind of just the making of the show, that it was shot in Chile. And really a lot of the questions from the audience were about, you know, was HBO okay with the Spanish language show that is primarily in Spanish? Really just kind of where the idea for it came from, which sounds a lot like it just came from Fred Armisen visiting Mexico City and really wanting to do a show there. But the takeaway I got from the panel was that, and this is great if you've seen it or if you're going to see it, really the key to the show is it's the other side of Scooby-Doo. It's like all of the scheming and all of the making the masks and the setting the traps that the villains do in Scooby-Doo. That's basically what this show is about. Like, who does those things and how do they do it? And who are the friends that get together to create these horror effects and things? So that's really what the show's about. It's about four friends in Mexico who call themselves Los Espookies and kind of do parties and exorcisms and stuff for films and kind of their bond of friendship and all the weird characters that they are and that surround them.
Horror group is how they describe themselves. And every time it comes up, whoever they're telling is like, what's a horror group? So the other side of Scooby-Doo is a great description. And yeah, our cast is Ronaldo, Andres, who is a chocolate heir, that's the Julio Torres character, and then sisters Ursula and Tati, and those are played by, I forget who the Ursula actress is, she's new to me, but Tati is Ana Fabrega, who co-created the show with Julio Torres, and if she looks familiar, it may be because from where I know her is the girlfriend of the lady who lives in the woods on At Home with Amy Sedaris.
Oh, yeah, okay, all right, yeah, I thought she looked familiar, okay, yeah, she's amazing.
It's hard to make that connection because she barely talks in that part, but yes, that's her. It starts out in the pilot with them, with Ronaldo making a lot of horror effects for his sister's goth quinceañera. And then their local priest wants to hire them to fake an exorcism because he needs the heat because he's getting outshone by, as Omar said in the intro, the new priest who has extremely glossy lips and is apparently personal friends with the Pope. They're on like a text chain, we're given to understand. I want to throw this to Dave, weirdly, because I was not expecting you to like this, and you really were delighted by it.
It's in my like top shows of the year, for sure. I was so pleasantly surprised by this show. If all the questions were at ATX, you know, a lot of them were about, was HBO nervous about a Spanish language? It is not a barrier to entry at all. I would imagine from HBO's perspective, since don't they have a whole Spanish language service?
They do, and this is the second show they've done that's not in English. They also did the Italian, My Brilliant Friend, which is in Italian, so it's not the first time they've done something other than English on the main channel, but yeah, they have a lot of original programming on HBO Latino.
Right, so for them, it's less a gamble. It is more like a crossover opportunity for them. This is a win-win if it's a good show.
Well, I just wanted to break in to say Sarah also mentioned Epitaphios, which she's talked about on the show before, which is another HBO original that's in Spanish.
This show for me was a delight, and I think explaining it as the other side of the Scooby-Doo equation kind of short sells it a bit because it has this very supernatural tinged in the real world element to it.
Yes, magic is real in this universe. Yeah. There are mirrors that are cursed.
It has a very 30 Rock, Kenneth is immortal sort of acceptance to it, right? Like it's there in the background. It's recognizable, but it's also supernatural at the same time. And it lets them play around with the characters and the universe so much, so quickly. It is out of the gate, full speed. It is great.
Sarah, I'm hearing you chuckling, even though you're not a sitcom person. This one seems like it got through your defenses.
It did. I mean, just like I eventually stopped even making any notes because I was just writing down like every single line of dialogue. And I was trying to think of what it was exactly that made me like it so much and find it so charming. And I think it just has this perfect balanced touch. It obviously loves like the horror genre and supernatural, but it also loves the people who love it. So there's this fondness in the way these people are imagined that's really great. And it's just really appealing. It's hilarious, but it's not mean. Like, except to the ambassador, but who can't, like, it's in some sort of code. It's in Spanish. Like, just the delivery of that exchange was so good. I loved it. I can't wait to keep watching it. It's really good.
The ambassador Sarah's talking about, she sort of, if you're familiar at all with Futurama, there's an episode where Zoidberg instigates an invasion on Earth and he's running through Embassy Row and he goes through a whole bunch. And the last one's the Klingon embassy that looks like a Barbie house. That is the U.S. embassy in this fictional country where the show takes place. It is really funny.
Yeah, she's very Legally Blonde. Melanie Gibbons is her name, and the big international incident seems to be that her advisors did not talk her out of getting bangs.
Yes, I was just going to mention that.
So we also, as part of our prep, I basically bullied Dave into also watching Julio Torres's half-hour Comedy Central special, which you can find on the app. And just because every time there was a joke on the show that was definitely a Julio joke, like I felt like it would come through when Dave watched the stand-up special. And so when you get things like, I know you're not good with time, so I'm going to turn over this hourglass, and then Andres, who is the Julio character, can like see it in an amulet that he wears. Like it's enchanted. He can see where his time is. There's another town that hires them to create an effect because they've lost their main tourist attraction, which is a little owl with a wig. Stuff like that. So clear. Those are definitely Julio jokes. And there is even a joke, which I had forgotten in the special, about bangs, where he says this was a science fair experiment that he did as a kid. And his hypothesis was, oh, she can pull it off. And I was right. Anyway. Yeah, it's an extremely specific expression of an extremely specific sense of humor. And like to the effect that I know I say this about so many shows that we talk about, but like, I can't believe it exists.
Yeah.
But the other good thing about the four leads is that in another show, these four leads would be sort of the, oh boy, I'm dating myself, but these would be like the Fangoria weirdos in high school. And they're yeah. a little off kilter, but pleasingly so. They're not menacing. They're not creepy. They're not the guys that probably burn their cat in the spare time. Like these are like enjoyable characters who are fun and lighthearted, even when they're being dark. It really sells everything that's going on. And there's so many things going on in the show. Like it is really, really dense, plus an immense amount of advanced planning all happened at once. Like there are payoffs as you go through the season. The character of Toddy, who seems just like there might be something wrong with her. Like she might be simple. Like we're first introduced to her, she is actually spinning a broken fan for the father as the other people talk to her. And then like he has to like, I'm sorry, it's not cool enough. I'll have to let you go. And she's like, well, that's the way life works. One minute you're the fan, the next minute you're not. And then she shrugs and leaves the room. But then later in the season, and this is not, I'm not going to spoil it, we seem to get a sense that there's a reason. Like we get this glimpse, there's a reason why she acts like she does. And it's a very post-internet, post-Comic-Con show that is at once lighthearted, funny, geeky, but also has a mythology to it. I can see this being like a really, really big cult show.
Yeah, I think all the characters are really well drawn. They're all distinct. And, you know, even among the oddballs, like Tati is like the oddball among the oddballs, the one who's always a little bit off. But like you said, like with good reason. And yeah, for six episodes, my thing was, after seeing the pilot is so strong that I thought, oh, they're going to be able to keep this up, you know, even for six episodes. And the second one, I wasn't as crazy about. I thought it kind of dipped a bit in quality with all the mansion and the ambassador stuff. But then it felt like it got right back on track. So I was really pleased we've seen all six episodes. I think all of us have. And I just think it really just builds into something really special and really wonderful.
Ronaldo is very delightful to watch. He's sort of the leader, and I love that they have a runner where he's so excited to just keep doing jobs he forgets to get paid or even to ask what people are willing to pay him, until Ursula, who is more pragmatic, takes over. And of course, Ursula has to be more pragmatic because Tati has gotten involved in a multi-level marketing scheme for Herbalite, which I also thought was very funny, the Spanish version of Herbalife. Yeah. It has a lot of lore. For only six episodes, it establishes a lot about this world and is very pleasant to live in.
Yeah, one thing I was concerned about going into it was like, how much Fred Armisen is there going to be in it? Is he going to, like, you know, dominate the show? Yeah, there's like just enough Fred Armisen in it. And I was someone who got really burned out on Portlandia after a couple of seasons and kind of just bailed on that. And I thought, oh, is this going to be like Fred Armisen and his buddies, or is he going to be like the Danny DeVito of It's Always Sunny character? But there's just enough of him and he's very good in it.
I get the sense he's the show's patron.
And it's a Lorne Michaels production. It's a Broadway,
There is so many characters we haven't touched on. There's this news magazine show that goes through the series.
Gregoria.
Mira esto, yeah.
You don't really need to know what that, you know, means as you go along, except for in the first episode, the host is throwing to commercial and it's like, and when we return, we'll meet a restaurant owner who claims an angel has been calling and placing long, complicated orders, but never picks them up. And then that's like, that's the scene, just nonsensical at times. And I'm here for that. I had a question for Omar. This might be a really stupid question. There is a line that Tati went to Minnesota to learn English, and she came back with a Minnesotan accent. Was she actually talking with, like, she's speaking in Spanish, so I can only hear Spanish because I'm super white.
Yeah, like her Spanish sounds a little bit different than everybody else's, so I think that was a way of, like, explaining away. And there's a lot of that on the show where they will, like, have a flashback and they say, thank you for sharing that flashback, or like something where they they totally call out, like, what just happened, you know, when somebody's giving a look off into the distance, like, don't give a look off into the distance. Like, they will completely reference something that happened in a way that's really funny and delightful, kind of catches you off guard.
Yeah, I saw Armisen with Torres and Fabriga on Late Night with Seth Meyers last week, and they were talking about how they all made fun of Fred Armisen's Spanish accent because he thought he spoke great and they thought he sounded ridiculous. So maybe that's a characteristic they also gave to her.
He does sound like someone who fits the character because he spends a lot of time in LA and his family's in LA. So that does make sense for that character.
There's also Tati's internet boyfriend, but we shouldn't say more about that.
Yeah.
that was a good runner. Oh, Tati.
And the Scooby-Doo stuff, like, that might make it seem like it's broad. It's not broad at all. Like, the humor can be very subtle and very sharp. And like, one note that I made in an article that I wrote about it for Primetimer was that they never push too hard for the jokes. The jokes always land because they're not pushing over the top. Like, it never feels that like it's going too far.
Well, it's kind of process-y, too. Like, they've obviously thought about what this would, like, be if this were a real thing. Like, how would this look if these people were doing this business? So
yeah,
there's
how,
like,
would you make these practical effects on no budget?
Yeah. Like, there's like a sort of depth of knowledge and fondness that is very appealing, but it's also hilarious.
There's a great example of what Omar was talking about when the valet company is doing their Hill Street Blues roll call and the shift manager is like, we got a big VIP project coming up. It's hosted by Boingo. And they're like, Boingo. It's like, yeah, you know that service where you go to the airport, it says free internet and you log on, but it's not free. That's Boingo. Charles Boingo. And they're like all nodding their head. They just move past it and on to the next thing. Yeah.
It's a good show. You should watch it.
It is now time to go around the dial for Stop Tara.
Younger is back on TV Land for its sixth season. I would not have guessed at the start of the show, which I really like and find quite charming, that it could sustain the premise of a 40-something-year-old woman passing as a 20-something-year-old woman for this long. But it has. And every season, as more, you know, as with all shows where the central premise rests on someone keeping a big, big secret, as it goes on, more and more people have to get brought into the cone of silence. And now it feels like almost everyone relevant knows that Liza is actually old as hell. She's 42. Now Charles, who is her boyfriend, has left the publishing company where, you know, all of the main characters worked. Kelsey, the younger publisher of Millennial, which is an obviously millennial imprint at this bigger publishing company, Empirical, she has taken over as publisher, and already there are signs that, like, it is, as they fully call out and name in the first episode, a glass cliff situation where the company was teetering on the brink, and so they've given it to a woman to basically, you know, consciously or unconsciously pin the failure of it on her, because this is something that happens with a lot of female CEOs. It's a real thing. And I like that the show is calling it out, like it's actually making this a plot point of how this happens in business, and also that it's publishing. So even though there have been sort of hints all along that the company is never doing great because it's, you know, the 2000s and that's how it is for publishing, like now it's going to be a main plot point, which is kind of depressing, but also kind of important to do if you're going to set your show in the world of book publishing. And the premiere, which was last week, had the Miriam Shore character, Diana, who's the head of marketing, really not love that Kelsey has been given this big job, especially once she finds out that part of the reason that Charles has left is that he and Liza were in a relationship and she's always kind of had a crush on him, even though she's dating someone else now. She storms out. She lets it be known that she's looking for another job to make sure that, like, the rumors start flying around the publishing world so that everyone is aware that she's on the market and not happy. So they find her at Marie's Crisis, and they manage to get her on side by requesting 9 to 5, and they sing Hilary Duff, Sutton Foster, and Miriam Shore, a former star of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, sing 9 to 5, and it's fucking great. Like, I don't care what imaginations they have to get to. Like, I could handle a million other scenes like that with even flimsier pretexts for getting these three singers together in a scene. But it's also a great song. Like, there's a reason it's Elizabeth Warren's walkout music at her rallies. It has a lot of meaning to it. The movie is also great. It's always an excellent reference. And I'm excited to see where the show goes now, because it has a lot more edge, and I think that is good for it. So Wednesday nights on TV Land. I think it was on Paramount last season, but it's back. And for my plug, I'm still digging out from under post-ATX stuff, so I will just mention our Melrose Place and Beverly Hills 90210 podcast, Again With This, where you can find it where all podcasts are. We're getting very close to the revival launch, more news coming out every week, including Emily Valentine returning. Yeah. Christina Lise herself is going to be in it. That was the big news this week. So very exciting. You will want to be subscribed for when we start talking about that. So Again With This, find it where you find podcasts.
Omar.
Tara mentioned last week Alternatino with Arturo Castro, a new sketch comedy show on Comedy Central that we got to see at ATX Fest. The first episode of that has aired by the time you hear this on Comedy Central, and they had put the first episode online for free. I've seen half the season, which is 5 of the 10 episodes, and it's really good, you guys. I mean, it is. I have not seen a bad sketch in all 5 episodes that I've seen so far. In fact, I watched one today that has Arturo as Pitbull, like questioning whether he might not actually be so awesome. It's brilliant. The writing is sharp. The directing is great. It looks good. I mean, it's not at the level of a Key and Peele yet, but it definitely has those same kind of that level of quality of filmmaking and writing. It's real sharp and really good. And Arturo Castro, who you might know from Narcos or as Jaime on Broad City, is just really, really bringing it. He's great in as every character that he plays on the show. So I'm real impressed with it, and you should definitely check it out. Another show that you might want to just keep an eye out for it, because there's no release date yet for it, but it should be in the next couple months, is called Undone. This screened at ATX also, and it is a weird show. It even for our peak TV streaming age, it is a rotoscope animated series that's going to be on Amazon. Takes place in San Antonio, and it's about a woman who fears that she might have inherited schizophrenia and is dealing with a bunch of family issues, but it kind of goes from kind of standard kind of family fare in the first episode to like a really psychedelic, weird look as her mind kind of unravels. Bob Odenkirk plays her father on the show. Rosa Salazar, who is the main character in Alita Battle Angel, is the voice of the main character. And I'm really curious to see what people think of it. I actually really loved it, but I'm curious if people will take to the animation style, because it's really, really distinct and different. It's from the team, one of the writers from BoJack Horseman, and the creator of BoJack is one of the producers on. So that's Undone, and no release date, but they're thinking it might be like July or August, because I think that's when they're going to finish up production on the first season of it.
BoJack did a pretty good job with mental health issues, so I can see that totally working.
Yeah, it's really good at that. Like, it's really good. I'm just for me, rotoscope animation is a little kind of dicey proposition. I've never really fallen in love with that style of animation, yeah. So I'm just curious if people will take to it because of that. The first episode doesn't even feel like it should be animated. It just, there's nothing in it that feels like it needed to be animated. But after the second episode is when it starts getting really visual and different. So I'm curious if people will stick with it.
Is it a comedy?
No. There's funny bits in it, but it's a real heavy psychological drama about trauma and depression and her father had died when she was young, and so she's dealing with that, and he kind of comes back to kind of guide her through what's happening to her, and that's the Bob Odenkirk character, who's really good in it. Bob Odenkirk's fantastic in it, and so is Rosa Salazar. She's really good as a lead in the show.
Cool.
Yeah, so watch out for that. My plug is today, as we're recording this, the Washington Post launched a series of travel guides for 50 different cities, one of them being Austin. And ooh. I got to write the guide for Austin. I've been having to keep this a secret since February. And as I've been working on it, I finally got to talk about it today. It's beautiful. I'm so impressed with it. The photography is amazing. The design work they did on it, they had people design postcards for all 50 cities and the logos. It really is a fantastic package. I'm so impressed with all the work they put into it. So it's called By the Way. And if you just go to the main Washington Post website, look up, it's on their main navigation now, By the Way. And they have a really good Instagram account at By the Way. So look for that.
We'll link it in the show notes too.
If you're going to visit Austin, I got your picks for you right in there.
You should.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Claws returned, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before. So I love the show, and I was happy to see it again, but I think I might be mostly happy to just see it. Like, I think that I might be content to just look at it and not really care what they're trying to do plot-wise. Is anyone else watching?
We're watching. Dave and I are watching.
I mean, do you agree that there's something a little eh?
Well, they just reset the stakes of the show every season, mm-hmm. sort of. It's gone from pill storyline, and then it reset the casino storyline. They'll do this for a year, and it'll reset to, you know, whatever, their tete-a-tete with some mob or something, you know, in the larger picture. Like, that seems to be the formula the show is following, so you really have to lean back on characterization and relationships when you do that kind of thing, which, you know, they do well, but it's a little unsatisfying that way.
It just feels a little flat, and like they're really trying to make these new like big bads of the season the co-owners of the casino, but I feel like the show at this point needs to either just go even more surreal and stop caring about like the bounds of realism at all, mm-hmm. or it needs to be a little more like, I just don't feel like there are any stakes at all. And maybe that's not what the show is trying to do, but it does feel a little bit flat and slow to me this year so far, just because I don't feel like I necessarily have to care that anything really bad is going to happen to people. Like the thing that we went out on last season, which was Virginia getting shot in the head. Now she has an excuse to wear all these like designer eye patches with giant sunglasses over them. My people, I'm not saying the show does not have its delight still, because it does. And you know, I like all the characters and I'm happy that Quiet Anne got to preside over a, you know, Miss Florida Muscles contest. Good for her. She deserves it. But I'm just not in like a hurry to watch it like I used to be. I don't know if anyone else is having that experience where it's not as essential.
I'll say, after writing very in-depth recaps of it for season two, I by the end of it, if I felt kind of icky about it. I still love Niecy Nash forever. I always will, obviously, duh. But there's something about the setting of the show that felt increasingly over time, like, condescending. Like, if you contrast a show like Claws, which has set up, you know, these like Dixie Mafia dirtbag criminals, with a show like Justified, which is obviously very different, but it never felt like, as bad as these characters were, it was this determined to rob them of their dignity. I realize how dumb this sounds, but especially like introducing the casino characters, it was like, and now here's a weirdo like sucking on an oxygen tank all the time. Like, it just felt like, it's so cartoony, and maybe that it always was, and I just, you know, had my Niecy Nash goggles on, but it's increasingly it feels icky to watch it, because it doesn't feel like it's coming by these observations in an honest way. I don't know.
I think it worked while everybody was in a low-stakes nail salon and their role was to facilitate a relatively small operation to peddle opiates. But when you sort of, they graduate up the criminal ladder, that gang, like, it shouldn't be able to operate. Like, those are very dysfunctional group of friends. And the way they either fail upward, that is what seems at odds of where they started. And it just kind of feels like the bigger the show wants to get in, you know, in the criminal world, the less fulfilling it is to watch our characters survive in it.
Is this your issue, Sarah?
And also, you know, they're trying to occasionally be real about issues, like, you know, one of Jen's kids' dads has just got out of prison, and she's sort of confronting, like, you know, her daughter doesn't even know this guy, but at the same time, the, you know, father of this child is African American, and Jen is not. And I think there's like, I mean, I think it's a good faith attempt to engage how this character would be in this situation. But I also feel like in the larger milieu of the show, it's like they'll try to be real about certain things, but then there's like a dance sequence. And I'm not saying that those things can't coexist, but for whatever reason in season three, it's not it's not harmonious, these things. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to quit watching it, but I'm not rushing to watch it live either.
Yeah, I agree.
And listeners, if you're agreeing or not, let us know what you think. For my plug, everything is coming up Omar in my podcast world this week. He was a guest on Blotter Presents 101, talking about an excellent movie, Robert Redford's Last, and a pretty good documentary. And you can listen to that as you're listening to this. Right now, should have dropped.
Season three and the final season of Jessica Jones dropped on Netflix recently. I don't have a lot to say about it, except it is so slow and boring. I feel like I'm watching the third season out of an obligation to the memory of the first season. But basically, here is what you need to know about the third season. I will keep this non-spoilery. It's Jessica Jones versus a neckbeard, the show. The stakes have never been lower.
Yeah.
It's turned into like the Patsy show. If you remember the end of season two, she sort of got jacked up and now she's kind of a superhero, but it's kind of lame. So she's sort of going into her Hellcat persona from the comics, and it's boring. And Jessica Jones is sort of a one note character, but it worked for the tone of the show. And Hellcat's just kind of boring and it's not really a very satisfying journey that she goes on. Boy, 13 episodes was way too long.
Oh. Too much.
This is like 4 episodes of content in a 13 episode bag.
Yeah, especially since like there have been at least 2 episodes that are really like, and here's the other side of the episode you just watched. Like, fit this all into one. What is wrong with you?
And they do that, but it's not like a compelling twist on everything. Like, it's
things
you could fill in yourself. You could fill in the blanks based on the first episode of what they show you in the second episode. Like, honestly, after watching this season, I felt like I could have watched every other episode and kind of got the same out of it because it moved that slow.
I agree. I will say 2 things about it, though. One is that if you are looking for a Jason Doring who doesn't have anything in his private life that you might personally not feel great about, look him up. You will know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to say. Here you get Benjamin Walker, who is the Jason Doring of not having weird stuff in his personal life. He looks the same. He sounds exactly the same. The character he plays is very Logan Eccles-y, so I'll just say that. Also, if you were hoping that like Jessica Jones didn't light your world on fire, but maybe Jet would be the dark-haired lady show that could, with a crime element that would fill in for it on Cinemax, we also watched the premiere of that and it was boring.
And it sort of had the opposite problem of Claws, where it was too serious and it needed to be a little more, I don't know, like Ocean's 11 elements to it.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's Jessica Jones. Kind of a disappointing end to it, but you know, it is ending. So went out with a whimper, not a bang.
Bye.
Yeah. For my plug, I just want to say Friday's Patreon show is all about an update on the Pierce. And to remind you, the Pierce is a character named after Pierce Hawthorne from Community. And that is a character that you can pick up from the show, cast it into space, and really the show won't change much. And will Malcolm from Jessica Jones be in the Pierce update? Stay tuned. We'll find out then. So for our Patreon subscribers, and speaking about Patreon, I think we're like $34 away from the final bonus episode goal. So if we hit that one, there'll be a new episode on Patreon every week. And so, yeah, I think we're $30 away. So if that interests you, and then probably if we end up doing 4 episodes a month, a lot of those months, the 4th episode is going to be game time, user game time. So keep that in mind if that interests you. So
thank you to everyone who has supported us on Patreon. You are
indeed
awesome. We love
Thank you very much.
This comes from Francoise. Her topic is Extra Hot Unspooled, and she explains, when I'm not listening to Extra Hot Great, I'm listening to Unspooled, a podcast dedicated to watching the AFI Top 100 films and analyzing/critiquing them. Let's do a crossover of my 2 favorite pods. What AFI 100 film would you like to base a television show on? For what network? And who would you cast in the leads? I did 1 and 1 bonus because
extra credit.
My first choice didn't have enough people to cast in main roles, and that's my favorite part of doing this. So I will go first, and then I will go again last. My AFI 100 film is Midnight Cowboy. It's based on a book, so I imagine there's a lot of stuff that they couldn't fit into the runtime of a film, and also that they couldn't get into a movie, even an X-rated one, but even back in the 70s. For my lead cast, guys, for Joe Buck, who is originally the John Voight character, I have gone with Ansel Elgort, Baby Driver himself. He just has to be cute and kind of dumb, and I think he probably satisfies both. I mean, he's a DJ in his free time, enough said. As my Ratso Rizzo, this might seem like kind of a left field choice. I'm going Timothée Chalamet. Now, Timothée is beautiful. We can all agree. But he has those features that are like right on the line where you can imagine, oh, if you just rough him up a little bit, he's going to look real weird. So I feel like that would work. Omar.
Well, my choice is Schindler's List. Hear me out.
Go on.
We seem to be living in an era where people think Nazis aren't so bad or on the other side of something. So I would not hurt to have a weekly reminder that Nazis are not good and that you should not support them in any way. I think I'm actually thinking of something like an anthology show where you would see all the people that were affected by Oskar Schindler's and who were saved and kind of what happened to them and when where their lives led from there. I would like to see Oskar Schindler played by Christoph Waltz, who I would like to see on TV mm-hmm. regularly. I think he'd be great in that role. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I could see something like this on AMC as a weekly kind of anthology show, reminding us that the Holocaust did happen and the people were affected. And yeah, no Nazis, please.
Sarah.
Keeping it cheery and John Boyle with The Deer Hunter on FX,
sure.
As reimagined by Donald and Stephen Glover and starring the entire cast of Atlanta, because first of all, they're great. Second of all, let's get real about who was in Vietnam versus whose pain we're always seeing in movies about Vietnam.
Hmm.
Three, let's also get real about how good Michael Cimino was at ending a scene, which is to say, not good. And number four, Atlanta, in addition to understanding pacing, really understands how darkness and laughter hold each other's hands sometimes, and nobody is going to bring it with that like Lakeith Stanfield, just my opinion. Dave.
Well, first of all, I don't think I've ever seen this list before. I knew of its existence, but I never bothered to track it down. So I was kind of surprised Star Wars was on that list because, you know, film snobs will poo-poo blockbusters. But that was on. I think Jaws was on it too. So
mm-hmm. E.T. is on it.
I was tempted to go with Star Wars, but since they're doing like a Star Wars TV series later this year, I figured I'll let that one be. So I went with another movie that I was surprised to see on the list, and that is Forrest Gump. And this is going to be Forrest Gump for USA Network. And because it's USA Network, they're not going to have a lot of money and they're not going to have a lot of integrity. And they're really just going to do some lazy casting to really just try to pander to as much audience as they can get their grubby little hands on. So here's my idea. So Forrest Gump for USA picks out the cultural milestone events between the ones you see in the movie. So like you remember, Forrest plays ping pong and meets Elvis and LBJ and all that sort of stuff in the movie. So this is like the things in between that. So for example, Forrest, when he's younger, needs to pee while at his first job at McDonald's. So he rushes through everything and unwittingly pioneers the fast food system, stuff like that. So Forrest, here's my casting. Again, remind you, we're pandering. We're getting as many asses in the door as possible with our casting. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but Christopher Hivju, that is Tormund from Game of Thrones. He'll be playing Forrest. Hear me out. Uh-huh. Therefore, Jenny will be Gwendolyn, the large woman, Christie, also from Game of Thrones. So they can be together now. So we got the whole Game of Thrones people already on board for Forrest Gump USA. Mm-hmm. Tara, I'm going to give you one guess who I'm going to cast as Forrest's mom.
Oh.
Mm. Older, motherly.
Okay. Cersei?
No.
Motherly. Yeah.
Maggie Smith?
No, Betty White, Tara. Betty White.
Oh, before. We should have known.
And as Lieutenant Dan is going to be WWE star John Cena. Our tagline for Forrest Gump for USA is, life is like a box of chocolates. Sometimes there's a second layer underneath that plasticky paper.
I would be remiss if since we're talking about Forrest Gump, to not bring up the story that went around a couple of months ago about how Eric Roth, who wrote the screenplay, had turned in a script for a Forrest Gump sequel on September 10th, 2001.
Oh.
That would have involved, among other things, Forrest being in the back of O.J. Simpson's Bronco during the high-speed chase.
Oh, come on.
It sounds completely insane. He did a charity dance with, he dances with Princess Diana. Like, it just sounds completely fucking demented.
Gulo.
Yeah.
I do remember reading the book like a long time ago, and there's a lot of stuff in the book they leave out. Like, I think he goes to the moon or something in the book or something weird like that.
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway, Star, what's your last one?
Yes, I went with Amadeus, one of my favorite movies. This, I feel like, could definitely work as a short-run series on FX, one of the few networks that will do a limited series and stop. Mm-hmm. For my Mozart, I got Justin Long. Feels like feels like TV's Tom Hulse.
Uh-huh. Yes.
the right age. For Salieri, I went with Jeremy Bob, the neckbeard, as previously mentioned on Jessica Jones. You've also seen him recently on Russian Doll. Big Iago energy off that guy. I feel like it would be a good fit. For Constanza, I went with Justin Long's love interest from the long ago TV show no one remembers but me, Ed, Jennifer Goodwin, very cute, very pixie-ish, and as Emperor Joseph II, very imperious, kind of an idiot, David Harbour from Stranger Things. Ah, and that is my cast.
Nice. It is time for the canon. Our guest, Omar, will submit this week. Take it away, Omar.
Thank you, Extra Hot Great, for allowing me to submit Atlanta, which we were just talking about, Season 2, Episode 6, Teddy Perkins. Now, when I was looking at the list of shows on the HG website, I was surprised to see that the show hasn't been a canon submission before. Over two seasons on FX, what at one time seemed like it was going to be a vanity project for rapper, comedian, actor, writer, and sometime director Donald Glover has become one of the most important and groundbreaking shows on television. It's not just about the African-American experience in America today and other issues of race, but a smart and often surreal show about class and money and love and music and what it's like not to live up to the expectations other people have for you. Teddy Perkins, which arrived April of last year, was a complete curveball on a series that is always impossible to predict from week to week. It was a standout episode, even on a show that regularly produces brilliant episodes. It's weird and funny and terrifying, and under the direction of Hiro Murai and written by Donald Glover, it originally aired as a longer than usual episode with no commercial breaks. We'll just get right into it. The episode begins with Darius, the show's mystical, conscience-driven character played by Lakeith Stanfield, standing in a hardware store making an unusual request. Clip one.
You got any dehydrated mango, ginger, jicama, perhaps?
No.
This place sucks.
If you don't know the show, this is very typical Darius. He seems to operate on a different wavelength than everyone else on the show. He ends up purchasing a red hat with a Dixie flag on it that reads Southern Made and blocks out some letters so it reads You Mad. Then he gets into his U-Haul as Stevie Wonder music plays, leading us into the opening credits. He arrives at an old mansion set behind gates and palm trees. He has come to this mansion to pick up a piano with colored keys that was listed on a web forum that he wants to get for free. The door opens before he knocks, and he's approached by a gaunt, soft-spoken man who resembles latter-day Michael Jackson and played by an unrecognizable Donald Glover in heavy whiteface makeup. His name is Teddy Perkins, and he introduces himself. Clip two.
In the car.
Oh, yeah.
Music of my mind. Masterpiece. I love Stevie.
Yeah, me too. I like to listen to it on long drives because his songs are long, you know?
Yes.
I'm Darius.
Apologies. I'm Theodore Perkins. Please. Call me Teddy.
Things get weirder when Darius is invited to sit in a parlor and watch Teddy Perkins crack open a gigantic ostrich egg to eat what he calls an owl's casket. It turns out that Teddy is the brother of a famous musician who played with Stevie Wonder, among others, back in his heyday. Clip three.
My brother and Ahmad, they were staying at a hotel in Brooklyn off of Bergen Street, $8 a night, if you can believe it. He told me something I'll never forget. He said, your brother plays pain better than anyone. Benny just played what he knew.
Teddy explains that he takes care of his brother Benny, who has a rare skin condition and can't go out in the sunlight. He tells Darius, maybe one day we'll get a great album out of it, a masterpiece. which is one of the first signs of what the episode is actually about. In other weirdness, Teddy uses what looks like an ancient intercom to ask someone to get Darius some water, but it turns out he's just recording a reminder voice memo to himself, and there's no butler. Darius is getting very uncomfortable, and when Teddy leaves him on his own devices, he starts to wander around the dark, lonely mansion. After he sees a photo of Benny sitting in a wheelchair covered in a head wrapping, he calls his friends Paperboy and Ern, who are sitting in a Crystal Burger drive-thru. Darius says he's beginning to wonder if Benny actually exists, and if maybe Teddy made him up to deal with his own physical transformation from surgery and probably skin bleaching. This causes the following exchange, one of the few bits of real humor in an otherwise very dark episode, clip 4.
Explain again, man.
Is Teddy the white dude or the black dude?
You know what? I don't even think Teddy exists, bro. I feel like
Benny created Teddy to make up for the fact that he made himself look like a ghoul.
A ghoul? And how bad is he?
It's real bad, man. I mean, bad. The nigga looked like somebody left Sammy Sosa in the dryer.
Sammy Sosa.
Yeah, skin bleaching. Look, have somebody type in Sammy Sosa hat in Google image search.
A few moments later, Ern pulls up the Sammy Sosa image search, and this is the reaction, clip 5.
Yo, shit! Oh, shit! Oh, what happened?
Yo, why
this
nigga the same color as his fucking hat? Damn, man.
Yo, man, why this nigga look like what's under a scab, though?
God damn.
Oh, God.
Darius is invited back into the mansion where Teddy Perkins shows him a gift shop and museum area he wants to open up. He says Darius is the first visitor as he leads him into a creepy as fuck room where a faceless mannequin meant to represent their abusive father stands. Clip 6.
This is my father. He's the reason for all of this. When me and Benny were children, he instituted a very rigorous training method. Piano 3 hours a day, twice a day. Exams on Sundays. That if failed, meant physical punishment. He wanted the best out of us. It's because of him we have all of this.
So you saying your dad used to beat you so you'd be good at piano?
To be good at life. We were a sacrifice.
He says he wants to honor fathers like Joe Jackson, Marvin Gaye Sr., Serena Williams, and Tiger Woods' fathers, as well as, hilariously, the dad who drops off Emilio Estevez in the Breakfast Club, before Darius cuts him off and says he wants to just move the transaction along. As Teddy is putting together a receipt for him, Darius says he wishes he could thank Benny personally, but by this point, Teddy's tone has shifted to anger. He leaves Darius to lead the bulky piano into an elevator, which ends up taking Darius down to the basement. Fine, destiny, he mutters. He encounters Benny, who can't speak, but scrawls on a small chalkboard, "Teddy, kill us both." Darius asks what Benny, who in his mind might actually still be Teddy, wants him to do. "Gun in attic," Benny writes. Because he still believes he's being toyed with by Teddy, Darius tries to leave, but his car is blocked. He goes back into the mansion and, armed with a fireplace poker, makes his way into a room where a film strip is playing. It's footage of Benny and Teddy's father forcing his crying son to play piano. Teddy is there watching the film. Teddy offers to move the car, and Darius asks for directions to the bathroom. Teddy says it's upstairs next to the attic, an indication that he knows about the gun. Things take a turn when he pulls out that shotgun and says that he's chosen Darius as his sacrifice. Teddy forces Darius to handcuff himself to a chair. Darius tries to reason with him. Clip 7.
You know, not all great things come from great pain. Sometimes it's love. Not everything's a sacrifice.
Sacrifices are necessary, Darius.
Maybe. But your dad should have said sorry. I'm sorry. Shit. I went through daddy shit myself. When you're young, you try to just make it be okay and say everything's gonna be fine, and that's just, you don't know the difference, but that don't give you an excuse to grow up and repeat the same shit over and over.
Benny surprisingly shows up in the elevator, picks up the gun, and fires it at Teddy. He motions for Darius to give him the fireplace poker. Before Darius realizes what's happening, Benny shoots himself. In the aftermath of the shooting, a dazed Darius watches as the bodies are carried out of the mansion, and Stevie Wonder's Evil plays, bookending the episode. Clip 8.
Evil, why have you engulfed so many hearts? Evil, why have you destroyed so many minds? Leaving room for darkness, where lost dreams can hide.
As the song suggests, the episode is a meditation on what breeds evil and what keeps it going. It indicts our culture of celebrating broken artists who are clearly the product of years of abuse and for equating struggle and pain with great art. It's a dark and notable turn for the series, but this is a show that always seems to be doing something different from week to week, so it's hard to suggest that there's such a thing as a typical episode of Atlanta. It is great filmmaking, it's got strong performances, and it delves into a topic that we rarely see explored on mainstream TV. It's an achievement even for a show that already regularly sets a high bar for itself. I hope you'll include it in the canon.
I feel like Sarah should go first because she's watched the whole run of the show more recently than we have. So why don't you start us off?
I have. And I also taught this episode in a college class that basically was like doing a live series of canon presentations for 2.5 hours every week. So I couldn't really point in class to why I had selected this episode as the exemplar for Atlanta. But I think that even though it's not typical in a lot of ways, it's a Bottlesque episode, it's also very typical in a lot of ways. I said earlier in the episode that this show and everyone involved in making it really understand how closely horror and humor walk together. And the scene with the egg is like, it's everything that the show does really well. It balances like this vile, like sound experience of him eating the egg. There's his hilarious memo system, which like, even if this were the only funny thing in the episode, it is so perfect that he like speaks into this intercom to tell someone, we think, to get Darius a glass of water, but it's actually just him leaving notes for himself. And one of the other notes, are like, finish the hat for Dionne Warwick and wash your hands immediately. Like just the, just the way it's done. And that performance by Donald Glover is just like, it gets at everything that was creepy, but also so like so sad about Michael Jackson, that, you know, this person never had a chance thanks to Joe. But then in the next line, after he mentions Joe Jackson, there's the father in the Breakfast Club, which is like, it's just perfect. And it also rewards, like, you can watch this out of order. My husband, who is not caught up on the show, wandered through the room like 3 minutes into it holding the vacuum canister and was still standing there 15 minutes later. I was like, why don't you just sit down? This is a good show. But it also rewards sort of people who know the show better, and, you know, that only Darius could have this episode happen to him with his like lifetime two regrets only rule or pact that he has. It's really, I told my class that there are times in when you're watching TV that you realize that something special is happening, that is changing the game while you're watching it. And this is one of those episodes, that how much it's doing, how sort of formally ambitious it is, but also it does everything it sets out to do. Ambitious, but also controlled and contained, and that there's so many genres in it, and the performances are good, and everything is timed. I mean, this is art. This is great television, and I'm thrilled that An Atlanta is up for a spot in the canon, but especially this one, which this episode is really, it's really something special and unique. And this was an excellent presentation as well. Thanks, Omar. Who's next?
Tara.
Yeah, I'll go next. I agree. I also have in my notes, this had to be Darius. Like this was the only person in the cast that could have this experience to the end, because everyone else would have left long before. But the build of it is so great. I mean, the ostrich egg is disgusting for so many reasons, but at the same time, like at that early stage of the episode, you just think, well, this is a crazy, weird, rich recluse thing.
Yeah.
The most disturbing part of that, though, is he dips two fingers in it at once and not one finger. There's something very creepy and sexual about that.
Well, and when they keep cutting back to him, like it's clear that like some shots his hand has yolk on it, and some they don't. Like this goes on, you know, like it doesn't feel like a continuity error. It's like an unfolding horror that continues to happen after the initial yolk touch.
And Darius is just like the minute it's been breached, he's like, oh, and you get a very good sense of exactly how every room in that house smells.
Totally.
Shot that well.
Yes, oh my totally.
God, you're right.
Yeah. Yes. But once they introduce the idea that Teddy and Benny are the same person, and thank God for that scene in the middle with the guys in the car, because at that point you need that relief. I mean, even just listening to the presentation, like you heard me laugh over it. Like we need that break. We need that relief of dread, like just for a couple of minutes. But then when we actually see Benny with his mask on, he's wearing the same thing that Teddy was. He's in the same robe with a dress shirt and stuff. And like the mask, his lips in the mask, like look kind of crooked. Like it looks like they might be part of he might have a mask on underneath to make his lips look different than the Teddy lips that we've been watching for the whole episode. Like it's very well built until that, the final shot. And like I had seen this episode before, but I had forgotten the details of like the actual plot of it. All I kind of remembered about it was the feeling, like the overall just how it felt to watch it. And I mean, Sarah encapsulated that very well, but just as on a plot level too, it's very well built. And if you've seen Get Out, like the echoes of Lakeith Stanfield, like going through his experiences in this and in that, like it felt very, the echoes, there are echoes between them, or at least
plus,
there were
plus
for me.
The camera flash scene, which seemed like the tip of the hat sort of thing to Get Out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not to say that this is a ripoff of Get Out at all, but you know, there, it felt intentional that they were nodding to Get Out. Sure. And you know, Sarah also said that it's also, it's a new, it feels like a very empathetic perspective on the real tragedy of Michael Jackson's story. Obviously, I mean, I can't top it. You know, he never had a chance, as you said, and this is a horrible reminder of a very sad life that made a lot of other lives even sadder and more horrible. So I mean, it wasn't a delight to watch it again, but it is, as Sarah said, this is art. It's an extraordinary episode and an excellent presentation. Thank you, Omar. Dave.
Okay, so my first question to Omar, and I guess to everybody, is Donald Glover's makeup, it seemed to be limiting his movement. Do you think that was an actor's choice, or like was it serendipity?
Oh, I don't think that was the makeup. I think it was him. Like the first time that I could tell it actually was him under the makeup was when he smiles.
Right.
Because somehow I could like his something about his mouth and his cheeks, I could tell that it was him under all
For
that.
Me, it was the eyes. He like looks to the side at one point and it was very like there's something in the ratio of his eyes that I was like, oh, that could be him.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it took me, I think, toward the end of the episode to figure it out when I first saw it. But do you mean his whole body movement also or just his?
Yeah, when you first meet him, just his mannerisms, the way he moves are very just like slightly off kilter. But in a, I just said slightly very off kilter, and I'm going to stick by that because it is.
Yeah.
That might have informed it, because I mean, the first thing you see is him kind of holding out his hands, and he just seems very fragile and weird and just like awkward around bird bones. Other people.
Yeah,
he just seemed to me like he's playing a character who does not go outside or move around very much. Like he's stiff because this is the most companies he had in a long time.
May not have seen someone else in 15 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, how old do you think that house is? Is this like a 20s house, a 30s house?
Yeah.
It's very weird to think of the era of house that really embraced the dark, oppressive entryway as like a fashionable statement.
Well, everything about it, like even the landscaping outside, this is someone's idea of how a rich person lives, but it's definitely gone to seed, like bad stuff is happening here.
Everything about the setting and the choices they made obviously was a moment trapped in time, and it all plays into that. I looked up Owl's casket because it sounded so real, but I can't find any references on the internet to it outside of Atlanta. So that's something the writers made up, I'm pretty sure, which is like perfect. Because it really sounds like something that should be called that.
Yep.
Did people actually eat ostrich eggs like that? I'd
imagine so. You know, if you can eat it, somebody's done it, right? Being stuck in a room with a weirdo is like one of my top two fears in life. Like it really like plays into everything that I find uncomfortable. Like human Well, first of all, I don't like people that much. And second of all, just being unable to call somebody a weirdo, or like when I'm trapped with like some religious person and they ask if you found Jesus, I'm like, well, sure. Yeah, Jesus is great. I'm like, oh man, I just betrayed myself. Too agreeable for the wrong reasons, you know, like I just want to like it to end. And then I just get myself deeper and deeper. And I find like, that's this episode kind of like just reminds me of the worst case scenario that's going to happen one day. I thought the weirdest signifier that something was very, very off about Teddy that nobody else has talked about is his plan to mix four different bottled waters together for Darius, Poland Springs, Evian, Foss, et cetera, that he's going to mix together. And it takes him like a good 15 seconds to get that whole sentence out too. That isn't like a signal to run for the hills. I don't know what is. The uneasy feeling I got watching this really reminded me of how much I didn't want to go visit my mother's parents when I was a kid. Their house smelled old. My grandmother was weirdly religious. My grandfather was going senile, and he was a racist and was all bubbling up now. He couldn't hide it anymore because he didn't have the wherewithal, you know? And it was like such an uncomfortable experience, including a scary basement. They had a scary basement that was like unfinished and extra deep. Like it was a good 12 feet deep instead of like the usual 8 or so. So it seemed like there was something even colder and more oppressive about it. And every time my grandmother would send me down to the basement to like retrieve canned peaches or something. And it was just like the creepiest thing. It was all cobwebby and gross and oh, so anyways, it actually reminded me of that experience of going to my grandmother's house. So well done, Donald Glover. My takeaway after watching this, outside of what everybody else has said, is that I'm amazed that this is the same show that brought us The Invisible Car. Like, this is the same universe. This is the same show that had this like great 40-minute horror episode that also had this ridiculous invisible car conceit in a different episode.
Mm-hmm. And it just aired didn't they just air right before this? It was the episode where Paperboy sort of like trailing his barber around with the drape on and like one like shave cut in his hair, and he's like, come on, man. I mean, which is also a great episode, but then this one comes right after it is like, it's awesome, but it's a lot.
Kind of makes me wonder. I think Donald Glover and his brother, they were going to do like a Deadpool animated TV show for FX, and it got scuttled at some point. But I feel like having watched enough of Atlanta, you kind of wonder what they could do with that show where breaking walls is almost the central conceit of the character, you know, like breaking the fourth wall. And what they could have done with that show, like well beyond what they're doing in the movies, right? Like just not in scope, but in message, you know, because the movies are just dumb. I would love to go into the what if future and see what their Deadpool show could have been.
And I don't remember what the timing was exactly. I think it might have been maybe a month or two after this, or maybe right around the same time. But that was around the time last year when the This Is America video came out, which was also the same director, you know, also Donald Glover. And was just as groundbreaking as a music video. It was incredible. So like they were really on this kind of creative hot streak last year as this was all coming out.
Yeah. seriously, the only knock I have against this episode is Darius has a smartphone but is using a paper map. That's like, that's it. That's the only thing I have to quibble
about. Feels very Darius. That's, to me.
That feels Darius, yeah.
Like, I don't think he trusts GPS or trusts, like satellites.
Yeah, or yep. Like, he doesn't want his location tracked, so. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And then just rewinding to the very start of the episode, there is nothing that will tilt you more than somebody online, especially when you're playing games, who has mastered the technique of you mad. Because there is absolutely no way you can win that argument as soon as somebody types in you mad. Like, you're playing a video game, the guy just killed you in a really cheap way, and you just call him out for it, or whatever the case is. They'll just reply, you mad, question mark. You're like, well, yes, I am. Yeah, like, you mad, or no, I'm not. You mad? It just keeps on going. Yeah. And it's just like, it gets under your skin. You never can win. As soon as you see you mad and you feel anything in your body stirring up, you just have to turn off the computer, go to bed for the night. Yep. You're done. So let's put this to a vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, definitely a yes.
Tara Ariano.
Yes, me too.
Absolutely. All right, that means Atlanta. This is season 2, episode 6. Teddy Perkins. Oh, the other creepy thing is he says Teddy and Benny, like other weird people say Daddy. I picked that up on the clips. You are hereby inducted into the Extra. Hawk Ray Cannon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and loser of the week. Tara has the winner.
Two early pickups. Just in time for Pride. Pose, after only airing one episode, has already been picked up for season 3. I've already seen this week's episode, which features Patti LuPone as a Leona Helmsley type, and it is amazing. Oh. Yeah, it's real good.
Fine, I'm going to watch it.
And also, Queer Eye picked up for season 4 and 5 on Netflix. I assume someone at Netflix thought them becoming real bona fide celebrities, perhaps in the new Taylor Swift video, and thought, oh shit, we better lock it down before they get too expensive. So good move, Netflix.
And the loser of the week, Sarah?
You know what, Bill Cosby? No. Bill Cosby tried to tweet a Father's Day message that no one asked for and got ratioed, I guess. Although, does he even know? Mm. Because,
the ratio.
I would like a ratio. Oh God, that guy. But he also owes O.J. Simpson a muffin basket because he was only the second least enjoyable Twitter event of the weekend.
Mm-hmm. What did he say?
I'll read it. Hey, it's America's dad.
Oh no.
I know it's late, but to all of the dads, it's an honor to be called a father, so let's make today a renewed oath to fulfilling our purpose, strengthening our families and communities, with 2 hashtags that he mushed together because he's an old man. Also, I assume I don't need to say, because he's an old man, lots of random capitalization in there as well.
Inappropriate!
It was.
Yeah.
It was.
Yikes. All right. Anything else there, Sarah?
No.
All right.
Do you know what else is inappropriate?
I do. Do you?
I do.
What
it's
is
game
it?
Time.
Oh, okay. You think people would just have the sense to like retreat from public life? Like, if you can learn anything from Kevin Spacey, just go away. Don't.
No. He came back.
He came back.
Oh,
yeah,
did he?
Did.
All right. Well,
yeah. He posted a video on Twitter.
On Christmas.
On Christmas. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Come on, guys. All right. Anyways, this is the 9th game time of the season. Why can't we find somebody who molests and drugs people that knows how to stay hidden? Come on. We're better than that. This is the 9th game time of the season. Season score is currently Tara 4, Sarah 2, Value Guest 2. Today we are playing I Was Told There Would Be No Math. From the EHG Assist team on Twitter and myself. In today's game, I will present you with a TV-based mathematical question you must solve. The correct answer earns you 1 point. No hints, and although I don't think you need it, feel free to use a calculator. Here is an example. The number of broke waitresses working at the Williamsburg Diner, plus the zip code made famous by some twins from Minnesota.
90,202?
Yeah, 90212 would be the answer. And that's how you play this game. Steel meal situation, please, Tara Ariano.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah is out of steel meals. I have 6. Valued guests have 2.
So don't forget, Tara, with a win today, would win the season. Sarah, I want to remind you, you do still have an extravaganza gong at your disposal. Nobody knows what it is, but it's there. Oh. It might be bad, but
you know, under what circumstances do I use that?
Whenever you want.
What does that do?
We don't know what it does.
It's the extravaganza gong. Anyways, Pinky will now figure out the order.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. So our order today is Omar.
I mean, great.
Tara, Sarah. Are we ready to play? I was told there would be no math.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Yeah. Do you want to use your extravaganza gong yet, Sarah?
Nope.
Okay. Starting with Omar. The number of minutes you sat through by the end of Andy Rooney complaining about self-adhesive stamps divided by the number of primates missing Brad Pitt and Bruce Willis.
Menacing them, you mean?
Missing.
Oh, missing. Okay.
I'm going to say 1.
Incorrect. The answer is 5. That's 60 minutes divided by 12 monkeys. 12 monkeys. The TV show did not have Brad Pitt or Bruce Willis.
I see. Got it.
All right, Tara.
Yeah.
The falsetto heralded temporal anchor of Conan's earliest otherworldly lit prognostications.
Mm-hmm.
Minus the year Martin Landau and the rest of Moonbase Alpha got exploded off the moon.
I don't know what either half of that is, so I will say 80.
The falsetto heralded temporal anchor of Conan's earliest otherworldly lit prognostications, the year 2000, minus the year Martin Landau, Moonbase Alpha, exploded off the moon, space 1999. Your answer, 1.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
The swankiest, most moneyed pyramid game show title to date, divided by the lowest cheap-ass dollar amount in a pyramid game show title ever.
$100,000.
The answer is 10. $100,000 was the most. $10,000 was the least.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood the question.
We still got that gong?
Our next 3 come from Dave in Chicago. Omar, the number of reasons why minus the jazzy numerical peak of the Pointer Sisters pinball counting song on Sesame Street.
1?
Correct.
Yay!
Finally.
Tara.
Yep.
The first amount of pancakes Forrest McNeil had to eat on review, plus the second amount of pancakes Forrest had to eat on review.
Oh, no. I know the second is double the first. Okay, what am I doing? Adding them?
45. Okay. Okay, to Sarah from Dave in Chicago again. The number assigned to the titular character who makes a real fuss about his contention that he is in fact not a number but a free man, plus the general accepted number of tries it took to convince the Time Lord patriarchy to give a Time Lady a go.
To give a Time Lady a go. I don't remember which one she is, so I'm going to have to guess. I believe my total is 9.
Your answer was
19.
That was number 6 from The Prisoner plus the 13th Doctor from Doctor Who.
I thought The Prisoner was number 2.
That is his nemesis, is number 2. Omar, the number of times Wild E. Coyote has caught the Roadrunner multiplied by the number of cases Elizabeth Tassiglione has lost a case.
I'm going to say 0.
Correct.
Hey!
All right, Ariana.
Yep.
Susan Lucci's Emmy nominations for All My Children.
Oh, no.
Minus Susan Lucci's Emmy wins for All My Children.
Oh, God. 17.
20. 21 noms, one win. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yep.
The number of people taken and returned by a ball of light in USA sci-fi series, plus the hospital number of MASH.
Oh.
Hospital number of MASH. Okay, the number of people plus the number of MASH.
Yeah, number of people taken and returned by a ball of light in a USA sci-fi series. Add to that MASH's hospital designation number.
4,067.
I'm talking about the 4,400 plus the 4,077. 8,477.
Oh, God, I got them both wrong. Fuck.
All right, we're now into some questions by Mr. Eric J. for Omar. The USS Enterprise's space license plate number minus everyone's favorite Christian club.
Calculator not working.
If you need to use a calculator, I guarantee you have a wrong answer.
Yeah.
Oh,
steel meals.
602?
The Enterprise's designation is 1701, and then we're talking about the 700 Club. Your answer, 1001.
That's why I got that wrong. Cool.
Tari, your next question, also from Eric J. Mm-hmm. They say you can't put a price on a life, but you can and we will, and this is Steve Austin's worth, divided by, first Jack Tripper proved this many was company, and then later that it was also a crowd, make up your mind, Jack Tripper.
6,000,003?
2,000,000. Jeez. Write it down or something as we go along. I don't know. What. Okay. Eric J., bring us into our first score break. This is for you, Sarah. Deep space multiplied by Babylon.
45.
Correct. Oh. All right.
Yay.
That's our first score break. Low scores.
I mean, it is a very close game, but not the kind you want. I have 0 points. Sarah has 1 point. Omar has 2 points.
It's like soccer.
Yeah.
Omar, back to you.
Mm-hmm.
The membership count and name of the worst of the worst coven from Once Upon a Time, divided by the number of bidders in contestants' row on The Price is Right.
Two.
You are correct.
Nice. Total guess.
Nice guess. Yes.
The number of seasons Real World completist Kim Reed has watched, plus the number of strangers picked each season to live in a loft or a boat or a house or whatever.
Oh, God. 37.
You were close. 40. 33 episodes, 7 people.
33 seasons? Damn.
Yeah. Yeah, seasons. Sarah D. Bunting. The number of Brady children who were not super annoying cousins multiplied by the number of Bradford children.
Oh, that are not super annoying cousins. Okay, 48.
Correct. Well done. 6 Bradys, 8 from children from 8 is enough. Omar, this question comes from Jamie P. The Veronica Mars nickname for rich kids minus Matt Saracen's jersey number in Friday Night Lights.
F3.
Two.
Ah!
Sarah D. Bunting, what's the nickname for rich kids?
That's O-Niners.
Yes, and then the jersey number was 7. You were very close, too. All right, this is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
This is from Jamie P. and Dave Chicago. I combined these two. The numerical dystopian CW series. This is for you, Tara.
Yep.
Divided by Sydney Bristow's time jump in years between season 2 and season 3. Divided by Tara.
I got it.
All right.
I mean, I've written it down. I don't know if they have the answer right. 50?
Correct.
Oh, yay! Good God.
2 years jump between season 2 and season 3 in Alias and the 100.
I only knew the 100, so I guessed at the other number.
Yeah, I would have thought it was 5 years.
I assumed it wouldn't be in decimal points.
Sarah D. Bunting. This comes from Dave in Chicago and Eleanor. The year that The Sopranos premiered minus the year in which Donna Martin graduates.
Minus the year in which Donna Martin graduates.
Soprano premiere minus Donna Martin graduates.
Donna Martin graduates. 6.
You are correct. 1999 Sopranos, 93 Donna Martin graduates. Well done. All right, this is for Omar. Blossom's bestie plus everyone's favorite Hawkins Laboratory escapee. Blossom's bestie plus everyone's favorite Hawkins Lab escapee. Gonna need an answer.
I'm gonna say 12.
Steel meal.
Steel meal from Tar.
17.
17 is correct. 6 and 11.
Oh, okay.
And Tara, here is your full question. Celebrity panelists on an episode of Hollywood Squares minus celebrity panelists on an episode of Match Game.
3.
She says meekly. Barely audible, but correct.
3, she said confidently.
Sarah D. Bunting, Nicole Bradford's titular dads multiplied by Steve Douglas's titular sons.
6.
Correct. My two dads and my three sons. This is from Eleanor, and it's for Omar. The number of spaces on the original Press Your Luck board, Omar, multiplied by the number of times Buffy died on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
50?
The answer is 36. 18 pieces, 2 deaths. 2 deaths. All right, this is for Tara Ariano.
Yes.
The designation of the Ray Roman-esque henchman who died on the Venture Brothers, minus the designation of the henchman who mourns him.
Oh, no. I don't remember either of their numbers. 8.
Incorrect. We're talking about henchman number 21 died, mourned by 24. Your answer, -3.
Wow.
All right, this is going to bring us into our second score break. This is for Sarah. The sum of the numbers in the name of Voyager's sexiest Borg crew member minus the nickname of the secretive doctor from House. The sum of the numbers contained in the name of Voyager's sexiest Borg crew member minus the nickname of the secretive doctor from House.
Okay, so I think that's 7 of 9, which is 16, minus 13, so my answer is 3.
Your answer is correct.
Yeah!
Wow.
And that takes us to our second score break in what is proving to be a very difficult game for our contestants.
Yeah, Sarah's killing it, though, with 5 points. Omar and I are tied with 3 each.
All right, everybody has a couple questions left, so put on your thinking caps. Omar, your question is from Eric J. The Munsters street address number is famous, minus Lucius Verinus and Titus Pullo's legion.
I know the first part. I don't know.
Well, show your math. What do you got so far?
I think it's 13-13. Mm-hmm. And what was the second part?
Lucius Verinus and Titus Pullo's legion. That's from Rome. And we're taking the address, and then we're subtracting the legion number.
1,300?
Good guess. And
wow, nicely done.
Hey. All right, Tara, this is from Chip. The century Buck Rogers unfroze in, multiplied by the number of rocks from the sun John Lithgow and company settled on.
72?
75. Shit. Buck Rogers in the 25th century. Third rock from the sun.
One century off.
Yeah. Sarah D. Bunting, This comes from Greg and Don A. Marla Gibbs' Mary address, brackets, spoken like Jack A. I hope it did it justice.
Yeah, pretty good.
Pretty good for you.
Plus the street number of Sherlock's apartment. Oh, sorry, minus the street number of Sherlock's apartment. So once again, Marla Gibbs' Mary's address minus Sherlock's apartment street number.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, it's 227.
Minus.
I'm not 100%, but let's just say that my answer is 6.
Yeah.
221B is Sherlock's apartment number. So 227 minus 221 is 6.
Negative B.
All right. We're going to end with everybody's last question from yours truly, starting with Omar. Liz Lemon's workplace street number minus the street number of Tom Hansen's base of operations. Liz Lemon's workplace street number minus the street number of Tom Hansen's base of operations.
30 Rock minus... God, I don't... I'm just going to say 20.
Really?
This is a guess.
Really help you if you knew who Tom Hansen was.
Yeah, well,
Sarah DeBundy might know this one.
Sarah knows.
I would have guessed 20 also.
We're talking 30 Rock and Tom Hansen from 21 Jump Street. Your answer is 9.
Tom Hansen. I thought his first name was Shut Up, because that's what I always say when I'm rewatching.
All right, Tara, here's your last question.
Yeah.
The total number of Did You See What We Did There dollar signs in the titles of Vegas, The Street, and Arliss. Give you a moment to process that.
Uh-huh.
Plus the dollar value of the single bill entrusted to Monty Burns by President Truman to help fund European post-World War II reconstruction.
Oh, God.
Add those two together.
Yeah, I forget. I think it's 1,000,000,004.
1,000,000,004 is the correct answer.
Nice.
Okay.
All right, this is the last question of regulation game time. This is for Sarah. Faith telling you she's got perfect reception strength multiplied by Faith telling you she's got perfect signal clarity.
I see.
That's for you, Sarah.
I see that. Could you repeat it, please?
Faith telling you she's got perfect reception strength multiplied by Faith telling you she's got perfect signal clarity.
I don't know this, so I'm going to say 1.
Yeah. Faith telling you she's got perfect reception strength, that is 5. Multiplied by Faith telling you she's got perfect signal clarity is 5. 5 by 5, that's where it comes from.
25. From
people in the
Army.
Doesn't
matter, you already clinched it.
Yeah, that means loud and clear, basically. But I hear that you may have already won, but let's make it official with the final scores.
It's true. Omar and I finished with 4 points apiece. Sarah finishing strong with 6.
All right. Well done.
Yeah.
It seemed like you weren't doing that great at the start, but you got over half the questions, Sarah. So
Yay, man.
Our tiebreaker will now be converted into a possible future use steel meal. First person to shout out the correct answer after I have read all the clues will win the steel meal. Are you ready?
Yes.
Here we go. The number of castaways stranded on Gilligan's Island who did not resort to cannibalism, minus the number of Big Little Liars of Monterey who also did not resort to cannibalism.
0?
2?
2 is correct. 7 castaways in Gilligan's Island, all of which do not resort to cannibalism. And then 5 of the Monterey 5 from Big Little Liars who also, as far as we know, did not resort to cannibalism. So Tara picks up.
Season's not over yet.
But today belongs to Sarah DeBundy.
Woo!
Hey.
Sarah.
Whew, well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We were possessed by the quirky charm of HBO's Los Espookies before going around the dial with stops at Younger, Alternatino, Undone, Claws, and Jessica Jones. Francoise asked us to bring a AFI 100 film to the small screen, and Omar made his successful pitch for the Atlanta episode, Teddy Perkins. We crown winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Math Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
beep beep,
Sarah D. Bunting,
wash your hands immediately,
and Omar Gallega.
1 minute you're a fan, the next minute you're not.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grade.
Oh, God. Peace, man.
All right, peace.
Put some extra fries in there.
Take them out.
Just don't eat them, damn.
You mad?